Welcome to Back to the Sources, a podcast for those looking for a window into the life of Concordia Seminary and our library, whether you are a theologian, pastor, or prospective student. Each episode explores deep theological questions, profound insights, and topics of interest, brought to you by both professors and students alike. We hope that these conversations enrich your faith, academic, and professional development by connecting you to our rich resources. Back to the Sources is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.
Hello, and welcome to Back to the Sources. Back to the Sources is a podcast of Hasse Memorial Library. And today we're continuing our series talking with authors from Grapho. Grapho is the student journal of Concordia Seminary. My name is Kendall Davis, an STM student currently in the exegetical department, and I also serve as the chairman of the Student Publications Committee, which publishes Grapho. Today, I have with me one of our authors from this year's issue, which you should be able to pick up, but I have with me Christian Dollar. Christian, could you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Christian Dollar. I am a graduate student in the PhD program here at Concordia Seminary in doctrinal theology with an interest in ecclesial ethics.
Ooh, sounds fun. So you actually have the distinguishment of having two pieces in this year's issue.
In fact, this is the second year I've had two
items
in Grapho.
That's right, because you had an essay and a poem last year, and now an essay and a Bible study. So I don't know if that's moving up or down. It depends on your perspective on poems and Bible studies. Yeah. Yeah, so we'll go ahead and talk about both issues with you, both pieces today. So we'll start with the first one. So you had an essay titled, A Disordered Estate, A Lutheran Approach to Institutional Evils. Could you go and just kind of summarize kind of what you're doing in this essay for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this real thing kind of comes out of the modern issues we've been facing over the last few years. I mean, with systematic and institutional problems being discussed like really they haven't been in decades, you know, whether those problems are racism or censorship or whatever you happen to like, you know, I think there's a need for the church to speak on these issues. With everybody yelling at each other all the time, you don't want the church to be just another voice screaming in the chaos. So really, my goal for the essay was to develop a way for Lutherans to speak theologically and responsibly about institutions, the problems that they cause, and kind of the ramifications, I guess.
Yeah.
So what I did is I kind of took a chance and I looked back at Luther's reinvention of the medieval doctrine of the three estates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the Middle Ages, you have the three estates that are used to kind of describe Europe's rigid class structure. You have the estate of the church, you know, the clergy, the popes, the bishops. Those are the ones who pray. You have the government with the nobles. Those are the ones who rule and fight. And then finally, you have the third estate, which is basically everybody else, the peasants.
Those who work.
Those who work, keep the farm running, have the kids, keep society moving forward.
Mine copper, whatever.
All those. Now, what Luther did was he still used these institutions, these three estates, because he was just born into it. That's just the way the medieval mind worked. But he celebrated as this reinvention of this doctrine. Now, we typically celebrate him in terms of opening up the rigid barriers between the church. You know, with this priesthood of all believers.
Sure.
Now suddenly everybody is part of the church, whether you're the ruler, a peasant. You know, it's not limited to just the clergy. But he also opened up the barriers for the other two estates as well. So while everybody, by nature of their baptism, is part of the church, you also have the peasants who are now part of the estate of government, albeit as subjects rather than rulers.
Oh, sure, I see.
Yeah. Actually, in fact, Luther says that even the monk who has renounced father and mother and worldly power and all possessions, you know, he still remains part of every single estate, you know, by nature of him being a son, by nature of, you know, him being baptized, or by nature of, you know, him wearing the clothes on his back, he's participating in that third estate of the family.
Mm. So then to clarify, every person in Luther's thought, every person is a part of all three estates.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
These three estates, you know, they structure all of human life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the unfortunate reality is, of course, that these three estates are not always, or don't always fill their responsibilities. You know, human life doesn't always go the way it's supposed to. But I argue in this that these three estates, whether it's government, church, or the family, is always filled by kind of a concrete thing. What I've called in this essay, the institution. So whether that institution is, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, the California, Hawaii, Nevada District of the LCMS, or your local congregation.
Wrath of God Lutheran Church. Wrath of God. Nowhere in Nebraska.
Oh, it was in Nebraska now? I always thought it was in North Dakota or Alaska.
There's multiple.
Yeah, absolutely. So these institutions, while all occurring within an estate, you know, all exist in different ways, but all are framed by at least one of these estates. Now, when these institutions that are kind of these concrete manifestations of these estates, you know, mm-hmm. when they get off track, you know, when the government becomes unjust, the church teaches heresy, or a family becomes exploitive, you know, these are what I have called institutional evils.
Sure.
So what I have done in this essay is I've looked back at Luther's treatment of the three estates mm-hmm. for a theological foundation for addressing these institutional evils. And really what you see is that these institutions can break down along two routes. On one hand, you know, an institution can exceed its appropriate responsibility in the estate, like when a church decides that it's not happy with just proclaiming the gospel and instead decides it's going to be the government now.
We're going to have an army, you know, whatever.
One of those things. Yeah, there's some sad historical.
Happen from time to time. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Or the government decides it's going to control the church, or the family can break down in any number of ways.
Okay.
So when an institution exceeds its responsibility or its mandate by the estate, it's the responsibility of its co-institutions within the other estates to set it right. But these other institutions can't exceed their responsibilities.
Sure.
And so they set these other, you know, this partner institutions right by its proper enactment. So when a government decides it's going to run the family, it's the church's responsibility to use its proclamation to remind the government of what its proper role is, while on the other hand, the institution of the family must, you know, be firm and not abdicate its responsibility to the government. You know, it must perform its proper vocation.
Sure. Okay.
Now, the second way an institution can get off track is by abdicating its God-ordained responsibility. You know, this was actually Luther's complaint and his appeal to the German nobility. You know, the ecclesiastical authorities have refused to address the abuses, mm-hmm. so Luther calls on the princes to correct the abuses themselves. Now, just real quick, it's important to note that Luther doesn't call on these princes because they were princes. He's not calling on the government to step in and be the church.
Okay.
Rather, he calls on all Christians to correct the abuses, and the princes were simply the best position to do anything about it because they conveniently wielded huge amounts of power and wealth. So Luther is explicit that they do not act as princes, but as Christians, you know, so long as they operate within the ecclesial estate. After all, they're part of it by virtue of their baptism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Later in life, he calls these princes emergency bishops, you know, and it's from this phrase that I've used the wider term emergency vocations to refer to that same principle in other estates.
So if I've got you right, you're saying that when a particular institution goes astray in these ways, other people who are inevitably part of that estate, they have a calling within that estate to correct however the particular institution has gone astray. And you're using Luther's letter to the German nobility as an example of that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Perfect. Yeah, exactly. And it's okay. these emergency vocations that are kind of sanctioned by this abdication of responsibility mm-hmm. by the institution.
Right. And which makes sense when you understand the universality of the estate, that everyone is a part of each of these estates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's the basic essay. Yeah, no, and I can see kind of a lot of the potential for like how this could be relevant in many and various ways in various contexts. One question I had in kind of thinking about how this would look practically is, you know, you have this category of institutional evils, but there are, of course, like institutions are always flawed. You know, they always like are doing, you know, not doing things they should be doing or doing things they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
To varying degrees. But is it a question of like severity? Of like when someone then has that emergency vocation? Because I'd imagine that like I don't have an emergency vocation whenever like something is just slightly not right, you know? like I could come up with like trivial examples of,
oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, I have a piece of mail that's delivered improperly, that doesn't mean I need to like now go like overthrow the post office.
Oh, absolutely. This parking ticket is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. So like how do you navigate? How do you know when an institutional evil in real life is it a question of severity, one, and then two, how do you know if it is severe enough to where this idea of emergency vocations start to come into effect?
Oh yeah, I mean that's the big question.
Sure.
How do you keep these institutions running and not just have a constant case of anarchy with everybody trying to overthrow everything?
That sounds bad.
It does, absolutely. No, and Luther, you know, is constantly against, mm-hmm. is constantly speaks against revolt, revolution, over and over and over again, which is
typically, quite strongly.
Which is typically where most Americans' minds go when they think of, oh, an institution's being wrong, let me grab my gun and go, you know.
Yeah. Have a revolution, man.
Absolutely, yeah.
American. We love it.
So there's actually a really interesting way that Luther uses to describe when these emergency institutions can come about. And
right.
Basically what it boils down to is when the estate itself is threatened. Now, that
okay.
is distinct from when an institution is threatened. Because again, remember the difference is these three estates are kind of the overarching framework of human society, and that there's particular institutions in a time and place that fulfill those mandates, those
okay.
three estates.
Okay.
But when it comes to when the estates themselves and their responsibilities are threatened, Luther does hint at the possibility of basically usurping the proper ordering of the institution of your vocations in these emergency situations.
Mm-hmm.
He actually has a couple of reoccurring metaphors that he carries out throughout his life to describe this. And one is, you know, the most common one that he brings up is a town fire.
Right. Yeah.
Where he talks about when there's a town fire going on, everything's up in flames. It's everybody's responsibility to put out the fire. You know, you don't wait for the mayor to organize things. You don't wait for the fire brigade. It's a do or die situation because everything is threatened. Now, he uses similar metaphors to make the same point. You know, in mm-hmm. one case, there's a rabid dog. You can't wait for the proper authorities to come in and put it down because the rabid dog threatens everything.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my favorite one is where he calls the Pope a werewolf that must be hunted down even if the government is going to try to protect him, you know, with the idea being that the Pope, by nature of his subjugating temporal authorities under him, his abuses within the church, and his rejection of the family with monastic celibacy, threatens all three estates at once. And so, in those instances, it is everybody's responsibility to reestablish the proper ordering of the estate.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the key would be to figure out is in whatever case of institutional evil, is the core functioning of the estate under threat? Is it like a town fire, and is it more like a town fire than say like, you know, a letter being misdelivered?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you can see this with Luther's treatment when it comes to tyrannical government. You know, he says no, you just have to basically suck it up and grit your teeth and just suffer the tyranny of a government, because even as a government is being tyrannical,
mm-hmm.
it's still preserving order. You know, it is not threatening to devolve society into anarchy because,
sure.
well, tyrants like to be on charge and have everything working towards them. So mm-hmm. even if a government is bad or is, you know, unjust, that doesn't immediately grant the opportunity for a Christian to pick up arms.
An emergency vocation.
Yeah, those emergency vocations.
Right. Although, I mean, I don't think he was necessarily using this framework. But so that would be, say, Bonhoeffer's involvement, say, with the plot to assassinate Hitler. Then he could make the argument that that's what's going on in Germany, that the situation in Germany is like a town fire. Whether or not, like, he's right, that would be the argument that he would make if we were to, you know, make him use this framework.
I mean, if I taught Bonhoeffer, I'd hope that's what he'd say.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if he was operating with this framework as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, I think that's helpful. Let's transition. Let's talk about the Bible study you've written up. So it's titled A Christian Sexuality, a 5-session small group study. So talk to us, like, what are you doing in these Bible studies?
Yeah, yeah. So really, how do I say this in a polite way? Well, first, let me say, I appreciate everything that the church has been doing when it comes to sexuality and kind of leading God's people forward. That being said, I have been frustrated a little bit with the way that the church has often done it within my lifetime, at least.
Yeah, yeah, in your experience.
And the way that I've characterized this in kind of the introduction to the Bible study is that oftentimes the church tends to treat sexuality in terms of negatives. Christian sexuality is not promiscuous. It is not predatory. It is not fill in the blank.
Yeah.
You know, and there's absolutely a time and place for it. I mean, Paul talks about that all the time.
Yeah.
I try to take a different approach, a more positive approach. And I think in the Bible study, I talk about the apophatic and the cataphatic approach, you know, referring to the you know, classic ways of talking about God, either by negation or by positive statements.
Sure.
And so what I've done with this Bible study is I've tried to frame an actual picture of what Christian sexuality should look like, not necessarily what it should not look like.
Right. Yeah. So we've had a bit too much apophaticism in our sexual ethics.
Yeah, absolutely. You send our teenagers out to college and they know, okay, I'm not supposed to do X, Y, and Z, but what am I supposed to be pursuing?
Sure.
And I hope this Bible study is kind of a step in that right direction.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's a, yeah. And it makes sense because, you know, if you're concerned about, you know, what the kids are going to do or not do, it makes sense to focus on those things that you're concerned about. But I think you're exactly right that if we want people to understand the life and the wholeness and the flourishing that's offered by the Christian vision of sexuality and the family, that positive vision needs to be put forward.
I think so. I think so. It kind of, again, we're not going to revert back to 18th century prudes, but, you know, in our sexual saturated culture, we need to have something to aim for, not only something to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I thought it was interesting you had kind of this format in your study, you know, the well I heard, you know, and the like, well, what about? And I thought this was an interesting way to kind of deal with, or at least kind of touch on some of the like hot button issues, but without it being a study on the hot button issues. So I thought that was interesting. I wonder if you could kind of say more about that. Were you kind of borrowing that format from somewhere? How did you kind of come up with that?
Actually, this is probably the thing I'm most proud of when it comes to this Bible study.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so what you're talking about here is there's two subsections in each of these Bible studies. It is a well I heard section and a well what about section.
Mm-hmm.
And basically all these two sections are is they give voice on one hand to kind of questions that would come up about Christian sexuality from outside. That's the well, what about section. You know, that's framed in questions like, what about homosexuality? You know, the culture's talking about these things, but you're saying something else. You know, how do we mesh these two together? Where's the division? How do we hold these two different informations together?
Yeah.
And what I've tried to do in that section is very much rooted kind of in terms of people and individuals. Just so we can talk about politically charged concepts, but in an interpersonal way.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I thought it was interesting because I feel like when we try to do this, we start with the hot button issue, right? We're going to do a study on, you know, homosexuality or transgender issues. And I thought it was interesting to instead start with, no, like, let's start with this kind of positive statement about, like, this is what Christians believe about sexuality or human bodies or marriage or whatever. And then, okay, well, then what are the implications for issue X, Y, and Z? I thought that was quite a helpful way to approach it, and I think refreshing in a lot of ways.
Oh, good. I hope so. But I mean, you gotta recognize, even with these positive statements, things don't always get the right picture. That's that goal of that second section. The well, what about?
Sure.
You know, and that section is really aimed at addressing kind of folk beliefs within the church,
right?
Or misunderstood Bible study or misunderstood Bible verses, things like, well, Paul told us it's better not to get married. Why are you telling us that God designed us to get married? You know, so it's a way to kind of just give voice to, you know, both sides of the issues, you know, questions that you might have from within the church, you know, a misunderstanding mm-hmm. of the positive vision and maybe these alternative visions we get from the culture of what human sexuality is supposed to be like.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think the military folk always say a plan never survives first contact with the enemy. And I think that's true for Bible studies as well. You know, like, I've always been surprised at some of the places that people are coming from. And I wouldn't have expected some of the things that they needed to be taught.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like, I remember I was teaching confirmation in a congregation, and one of the students asked me, like, well, how did Jesus die? And I was like, well, he was crucified. You've heard of this before, like,
we got a picture of it right up
yeah,
here.
Yeah, like it's all. It was like, no, I know that, but like, you know, like after he was raised, like how did he die then? And I was like, oh, like he doesn't like understand like the ascension and whatnot. And I would have never have like thought to like make sure to clarify. Oh, and then after Jesus was raised, he didn't like wait around and die like, you know, like as an old man somewhere, you know, but like he ascended into heaven and is alive even now. And that's a part of the story you don't think to emphasize. But in that interaction, really, it's like, oh, like, maybe that is like because this child, you know, like was in church and everything and kind of didn't quite kind of get that part of it. So it's always helpful to kind of be sensitive to where people are actually coming from so that then you can teach effectively and appropriately.
No, and I think you're absolutely right. And I really hope that these kind of structures, you know, of approaching these well, I heard and well, what about, you know, kind of gives Bible study leaders. Yeah, a model, absolutely. Mm-hmm. A model for addressing the myriad of other alternatives and misunderstandings that anybody is going to face if they get in front of a congregation and try to teach the Word of God.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to happen whether you plan for it or not, so you might as well plan for it. No, it's good. Well, Christian, thank you for your time, and I hope people certainly go and check out some of your contributions to this year's issue.
Yeah, I hope it's helpful.
All right.
If you enjoyed Back to the Sources, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Facebook so that you don't miss a single episode. This podcast is brought to you by the Hasse Library on the campus of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. The Hasse Library, inspiring theological discovery.